Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Yesterday, when we arrived to the shul and they gave us the tour, so the woman with the langa tzep, the president of the kehila, gave me an essay that she wrote, the shul was with somebody else, about the nature of the emperor's palace. So they claim that part of this is muskan, agreed upon by all the scholars, and part of it is their chiddush. So they claim that the part that's agreed upon is that there was a factory in the palace for processing textiles and for dyeing the textiles. And the scholars suggest that maybe the palace was originally intended only to be plant. It was never intended to be a palace. So that's their suggestion. Perhaps in the first place it was only intended to be a factory to process the textiles and to dye them. And then she claims in the essay that there are more than 12 menorahs engraved on different places, and every single time that it's engraved, it's in the middle of the stone. So we cannot assume that when they were digging out these stones from the mountainside, from the quarry, that they just put a symbol in it, because there are other symbols that appear in the stones that apparently were carved out when they were carving out the stones from the quarry. And they're not always in the middle of the stone, and a lot of times they're upside down. The menorahs are always in the right direction, always centered. So they feel that the menorahs were engraved after it was already installed, after the stones were installed in the building. So their suggestion is that the trellis used to be reserved under the Romans. The trellis used to be reserved for royalty. And the Gemara mentions part of this. The Gemara says that the trellis was very expensive and had to come only from the chalazon. We have to use trellis for tzitzis, and we have to use trellis for big de kuhunin. If you don't have the trellis and the big de kuhunin, it's not kosher at all. If you don't have the trellis and the tzitzis, there's a machlekes hatanoim, and the accepted psak is that you have a partial kiyama mitzvah. The mitzvah b'shleimus says if you have lavan with trellis, but you have a partial kiyama mitzvah even if you don't have any trellis. But in the big de kuhunin, it says explicitly in the Tosefta that trellis is me'akev l'chol ha'deis. There's no dispute. So the Jews used to be experts at dyeing trellis, and then the Roman government prohibited private use of trellis. It was reserved only for royalty. So the messengers who were delivering trellis, they didn't manufacture it all over. Sometimes they would be caught by the Roman government, they would be imprisoned. Sometimes they would be killed because they weren't allowed, it was against the law to make trellis privately or to use trellis. So they used to hide. Those who were selling them, distributing trellis, used to hide. So her suggestion is that they had Jews working in the trellis. This was the trellis factory for the government, to make trellis, and the government perhaps in the uniforms made for the soldiers, and perhaps only for the royalty, that they're not sure. This was her chiddush, this was her suggestion. In the late 1800s, there was a prominent Hasidic Rebbe, the Radzina Rebbe, who traveled specially to Italy. He heard there was a big aquarium there. He felt we have to show the Rabbanu Shalom that we're interested in rebuilding the Beis HaMikdash. We have to at least try to do whatever we can do. So he went to the aquarium, even though he didn't speak any Italian. Went to the aquarium to try to figure out. The aquarium had all the fish that appear in the Mediterranean, and the chalazon, the Gemara assumes, is somewhere in the Mediterranean, maybe in other places as well, but it's at least in the Mediterranean. That the Gemara has explicitly. They know that chalazon is a sea animal because chelis doma liyam liyam doma lerekia. That we know that it's a sea animal. Rashi and some Rishonim say it's a dag. Dog, does a dog necessarily mean that it's a fish? Or a dog just means that it's a sea animal? So this, for many years, it was always assumed that it's a fish, something that looks like a fish. So the Radzina Rebbe decided that it's the squid fish. So the squid fish spits off this dark-colored stuff. So he took the dye from the squid, and he had some wool, that was processed, he dipped in the wool to dye it with this color. And every time he would dye the wool with what he thought was the treles, he would wash it out later on and the whole color would come out. So he had a problem because the Gemara says the treles that comes from the halozen can't be washed out, that it holds tightly to the garment. He put an advertisement in the Italian newspaper. This was all when it was still in Italy. Put an advertisement in the newspaper. He's prepared to pay money to a chemist. He needs some help. So a Nochri chemist volunteered for money. And he said, what's the problem? So he said, we have the dye, and we want to dye. We want this dye to get absorbed into the wool, but we want it to be indelible, that you shouldn't be able to get it out. So the chemist said, the Rebbe said, we need a chemical that'll help hold the color in the wool that it won't wash out. So the Nochri said, no problem, and he gave him a chemical. So every time they used the dye from the fish, and they used the chemical, so they had the right color, and it didn't come out. So the Radzina Rebbe went back to Radzin, and they made a factory, and they were making trailers for tzitzis, and they were showing the Rabbi Shalom that we're preparing for the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash. And we started to do a little bit, so you do the rest, help us rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. So they had tens of thousands of Hasidim before Hitler came and he killed everybody out. There were tens of thousands of Hasidim, not only Radzina, who were wearing trailers in Europe before the war. So the Radzina Rebbe published three separate svarim regarding the trailers. Now they print all three together in one volume, they're called Shlosha Sifri HaTreles. So in a later volume, either the second or the third, I forgot already, I have the sefer at home, later volume, he has the reactions of the different rabbanim of his generation to his discovery of the trailers. And many of them went along with it. Yitzchak Hanan was the big paisik at that time, and he was the rabbi in Kovne, but all the big shaylas went to him. So his reaction was, he thinks that the Radzina Rebbe is right, that he personally cannot wear the trailers because he's involved in a big milchama, he's waging war against the maskilim. He's going to start wearing trailers, everybody will laugh at him, and then he won't be able to win the battle against the maskilim. Sounds very strange. If the Torah gives you a mitzvah that you have to put trailers in the tzitzis, what do you mean? If I'm going to wear trailers, I'll lose out in my battle against the maskilim. You lose. Look, that's the Rabban Shalom's job, to see that we should win against this. That's the letter that they quote from Rav Yitzchak Hanan. He agrees with the Radzina Rebbe, he'd like to wear trailers, but he can't because he's fighting against the maskilim. Very strange. Then he has among the various letters, he has a letter from a Talmud Chacham, who was close to the Beis HaLevi. That was Rav Yoshe Ber Soloveitchik, the father of Rav Chaim, the famous Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. He doesn't give the name of the person, he just says the one who sent him the letter was a close associate of Rav Yoshe Ber Soloveitchik. He was the rabbi of Brisk. He said, this friend of the Beis HaLevi writes in the letter, in the name of the Beis HaLevi, if you would have come up with a different fish and identified it as the Chalozain, I would have been the first one to go along with you to wear trailers. But you tell me that it's the squid fish. My parents and my grandparents knew that the squid fish exists, and they knew that it spits out this dark color dye. And they never used it. The fact that they were aware that such a fish exists and they didn't use that dye as the treles is an indication. It's like we have a tradition, we have a masorah that it's not correct. It cannot be that that's the chalos. It must be something else. You have to come up with some fish that was unknown to our ancestors, and you have to give a historical explanation. Why did the treles disappear in the days of the Gaonim? The days of the Tanoim and the days of the Amoraim, they always had trailers. Then after the days of the Talmud, after the days of the Gemara, somehow during the lifetime of the Gaonim, the trailers disappeared. So that's what the Beis HaLevi is quoted as saying. I'll only go along with you if you tell me that it's some fish that we didn't know of in recent years. You have have to give a historical explanation why it disappeared for so many hundreds of years. So the Beis HaLevi didn't accept this the Tchelus of the Ratzina Rebbe. The Soloveitchik family, both the American branch and the Israeli branch, all have a totally different version of what the Beis HaLevi said. Their version was that in order to identify something as Chalazon, you have to have a Masorah. And since the Masorah was lost, we didn't know for so many hundreds of years, you cannot restore a Masorah based on archaeological discoveries, based on going to an aquarium in Italy. Once the Masorah is lost, it's lost. For example, the Gemara has, sometimes we distinguish between two vegetables. One is orez and one is dochen. So Tosfos is not sure whether orez is rice or dochen is rice. So you ask any Arab, what is orez? Arroz is rice. You ask any Puerto Rican from Washington Heights, rice is arroz. Everybody knows. So Rabbi Soloveitchik's version, the Soloveitchik family's version of what their ancestor, what their great-grandfather said was that you can't restore, can't reinstate the Masorah of what is Orez. And since by the Rabbanim it was forgotten, even though you use all the dictionaries in the world and they'll all tell you that Orez is rice, that's not called a Masorah. The Masorah was lost, so we treat it like a subject. So here also, since the Masorah, Ish Mipi Ish, among Klal Yisrael, was lost, as far as what is the Chalazon, you can't restore the identity of the Chalazon based on studying all the different fish in the Mediterranean. This is the question, which is the correct version of what the Beis HaLevi said. So Rabbi Feibel Cohen of Flatbush, very big Talmud Chacham, wrote very serious for him that he used in all the yeshivas all over the world, and halacha. So he took off a year from his rabbanis. He had a rabbinical position in Flatbush. He took off a year. He told the Balabatim that he wants to retire from his position because he wanted to get shimush by Rabbi Yashiv in Eretz Yisroel. So the Balabatim, he was so beloved by the Balabatim, so they said he shouldn't retire. They said, we'll give you leave of absence. We'll save the Rabbanis for you. So he went to Eretz Yisroel for a year, and he wanted to pick up shimush in Psak Halach from Rabbi Yashiv. So when he came back to America, he had become so close to Rabbi Yashiv, he used to correspond with him, and Rabbi Yashiv would answer. Usually Rabbi Yashiv, after he retired from the Rabbanut, he used to be in the Besen of the Rabbanut. So after he retired, he sat and he learned, and he didn't feel obligated to answer people's letters. But because he was so close to Rabbi Feibel Cohen, so he answered his letter. So Feibel Cohen sent him a shaila, which of the two versions of the Beis HaLevi makes more sense to you? So he said, family's version that a Masorah cannot be restored based on archaeological discoveries does not make any sense to him. Why not? In fact, so many people ask, when Rabbi Soloveitchik would say this over, they would always ask. The Gemara seems to say that you can't restore a Masorah based on archaeology. The Gemara says that Rabbi Barbachana was traveling in the desert and he had a tour guide, and the tour guide showed him the Mesei Midbar. The Jews who died in the Midbar in the 40 years of traveling in the Midbar. So when he came back to the yeshiva after his tour was over, Rabbi Barbachana told the Talmidim in the yeshiva that he saw the Jewish Nesei Midbar. So they asked him, did you look at the tzitzis to count how many strings there were? Because in the days of the Tanaim, Rabbi Barbachana lived in the days of the Amoraim. In the days of the Tanaim, there was a dispute between Bishamai and Bishilo. When you take three long strings, you fold them over to make six short strings. When you take four long strings, you fold them over to make eight. So that's the position that we follow. You take four long strings, fold them over to make eight out of them. So they asked Rabbi Barbachana, did you count how many strings there were on the tzitzis? We should restore the Masorah based on archaeology. You saw the Mesei Midbar. So he said it didn't occur to him to count the strings on the tzitzis. So they said to him, what an idiot you are. Rabbi Barbachana, you're a moron. You're taking a guided tour in the Midbar, and you can learn so much, and halacha lemaisa, and you didn't look to see how many strings there were. So the Gemara says that he was a fool. So you see, from that Gemara, another Gemara is like that. In Shulchan Aruch they discuss the two versions of how you put the parshias into the tefillin. Rashi has one version, Rabbeinu Tam has another version. So some put on tefillin the Rashi and tefillin the Rabbeinu Tam. So in the Shulchan Aruch they quote that in the Kevei Yecheskel HaNavi they found tefillin that had the Seder of Rabbeinu Tam. So they considered this a raya already from the days of Yecheskel HaNavi. That's in the days of the Tanakh there was such a thing as tefillin the Rabbeinu Tam. The one they just say that we don't accept archaeological evidence to anything. That's what some argue. We don't accept archaeology. Well, I mean, you don't accept this if anymore that you do accept archaeology. So it's very strange. So Rav Al-Yashiv said, the version that the Soloveitchik family says he doesn't understand what that means. He thinks that that's not, Beis Halevi would never say such a thing. He thinks that the other version is more correct. So then Rabbi Feibel Cohen asked him, so what do you say about the new Trelis? If you're prepared to accept archaeological evidence, so here they have archaeological evidence that they think they found the Chalazin. So Rav Al-Yashiv said he's not sure. Okay, he gave a whole discussion what the issue is. But in recent years, the first chief rabbi in Eretz Yisrael in recent years was Rabbi Cook, Zichron Lebrach. He was a Kohen. And after he passed away, then there was a whole pilpul, and they appointed as chief rabbi in Eretz Yisrael, Rabbi Herzog. Rabbi Herzog was originally from Ireland. And he went to university, and his doctoral dissertation was on Trelis. And he made a whole research, he made a whole study. So as he studied the Trelis of the Radzina Rebbe, he was in touch with the people who worked in the Trelis factory. This was before the war. He was in touch with the people, and he wrote up all the ingredients, exactly how they make the Trelis. And then he tested everything out, and he claims in his doctoral dissertation that the chemist in Italy fooled the Radzina Rebbe, that he simply gave him Prussian blue, that after the Rebbe used the dye that came from the squid fish and it kept on washing out, so the Nochri chemist gave the Rebbe a chemical, not the chemical will cause the dye from the fish to remain in the wool, but the he gave a chemical that gives a dye, and after you have your tzitzis, there's nothing left on fish, even if the squid fish is the chalazin, but all the dye from the chalazin from the squid fish gets washed out in the water, and the only dye that's left is the dye from the chemicals, and that doesn't come from any fish at all. That doesn't have a source from a fish at all. So Rabbi Herzog claimed that the Nochri fooled the Radzina Rebbe, that for sure is not the Chalazin. So what is the Chalazin? So Rabbi Herzog showed, based on various Midrashim, Rashi in his commentary on Chumash quotes one of these Midrashim, but there are more, that Chalazin is not a fish. It does not have the shape of a fish. Chalazin is a mollusk. It's a sea animal that has a shell on it. When the animal grows bigger, so the shell grows bigger. Rashi quote such a medrash regarding the pasuk in today's sedra. When Bnei Yisrael left Mitzrayim, so they were wearing clothes, so traveling for 40 years, so the clothes should have gotten worn out. So the pasuk says in today's sedra, the clothing that you were wearing didn't get worn out. How can it be? You wear the same clothes for 40 years. So there were children who left Mitzrayim, they were wearing children's clothes. And in the 40 years, the clothing miraculously got bigger, just like the shell on the chalazon gets bigger when the chalazon grows. First it's a small shell, and then everything gets bigger when the animal gets bigger. So you see, the chalazon is a shelled animal. It's not a fish, not a plain fish. The Rishonim call it a dog. So Rabbi Herzog assumes that a dog just means a sea animal. Doesn't necessarily mean what we call a fish, an animal that lives in the sea. That was his chiddush, that he thought that it was a mollusk. And then originally, he made research, and they have museums where they have different fish which are the source of blue dye in the Mediterranean. How do you know that the trelis is blue? I don't know what color it is. Why do we assume it's blue? So the Gemara says, "Damal rakia." Okay, so the rakia is blue. That's one piece of evidence. The other piece of evidence is there's a dictionary for Talmudic Aramaic, which is called the Aruch. It was written in the days of Rashi. Rashi and Tosfos quote it every so often. So the Aruch quotes Gemaras and he translates the words. So he quotes a Gemara where the Gemara says that in the days of the Tanaim there were Garavim who would be selling imitation trailers. They would be selling what the Gemara calls Kiva Ilon, and it's really not trailers. Kla Ilon. So the Aruch writes under Kla Ilon, Kuf Lamed Aleph, Ilon, Aleph Yud Lamed Nun. Kla Ilon, he says, is indigo. So they would claim that this is trailers, and it really was not. Indigo is comes from a vegetable. And trailers is supposed to come, the source of trailers is supposed to be from this sea animal, from a duck, from the fish. So the indigo we know is blue. Rashi in his commentary on Chumash, at the end of Parsha Shlach, writes that the trailers is the color of the sky at midnight, because Makas Becharis occurred at Aybatzi Alayla at midnight. Tchelis is Milosh and Tichla. Tichla means death. So Tchelis is supposed to remind us of the death to the Makas Becharis, death to the Mitzrayim. The Rambam writes, not so, the Rambam writes Tchelis is the color of the sky in the afternoon. It's light blue. According to Rashi, it's very dark blue. Practically black, almost black. So that Rav Soloveitchik once spoke, he gave at Russia, whether Kabbalah sources and the Zohar and other sources, there's a discussion. But Tchelis is supposed to represent Midas HaChesed or Midas HaDin. If it's like Rashi in his commentary on Chumash, that Tchelis is the color of the sky at midnight, it's supposed to represent Makas Breris, then it represents Midas HaDin. If it's the color of the sky in the afternoon, the daytime is supposed to represent Midas HaChesed, not Midas HaDin. So it's the same color blue. The only question is, how much do you dilute it? Do you pour in a lot? Do you mix in a lot of water? When you get the dye from the chalaza, if you mix in a lot of water, then it's going to be the color of the sky in the daytime. If you don't mix in any water, then it's going to be the color of the sky at midnight. But it's going to be the same. It's going to be the same color. So that's how we know that the trelis is supposed to be blue, because trelis can be confused with kla'ilon. Kla'ilon is indigo, so we know that it's blue. So they have museums in the Middle East where they have all of the different dyes that are made from different fish in the Mediterranean. You use different fish to dye textiles different colors. So the only source that they have from fish to dye textiles blue is this mollusk, a certain mollusk, Uris trunculus, whatever you call it. And they found factories north of Eretz Yisrael, to the north of Eretz Yisrael, which seemed to have been trailers factories, and they had all the shells from these mollusks over there. So apparently, and the Nachrin called it trailers. The Goyim used to call it trailers. Apparently, this is it. This is the source. So so Rav Herzog originally thought that it's the Chalazon, which has to be the source of the trailers, must be this mollusk. But then he corresponded with the curator. He writes all this in his doctoral dissertation. He corresponded with the curator of some museum in Paris, and he raised the issue with him: is it possible that that is the source of the trailers? And he wants to know whether the dye that comes from that murex trunculus, is it an indelible dye, or can it wash out? So the fact is that it does not wash out. Rabbi Moshe David Tendler from Yeshiva told his students that he dyed some wool with this new kind of trelis, and then he soaked it in Clorox for a week, and it didn't come out. The dye doesn't come out, it's indelible. So the curator of the museum in Paris incorrectly misled Rabbi Herzog, and he told him, yes, that the dye, the blue dye that comes from this Burex trunculus, from this mollusk, it's going to wash out. It's not going to last. It's just like a lot of the other dyes just wash out when you wash the garments. So this one's also going to wash out. the Rabbi Herzog assumed that he was correct. He didn't test it out. He assumed that this curator of the museum in Paris knew what he was talking about, which was a mistake on his part. But that's why he shifted. In the end of his maskana, the last few pages of his doctoral dissertation, was that the source of the Trelis is a different mollusk that's found in the Mediterranean. And the color is not really blue, it's really purple. If it's purple, so that's traditionally we always assume that's what agamon is. Trelis is blue and agamon is purple. So Rabbi Herzog explained that it's from that same mollusk. Sometimes the dye is called trelis, sometimes called agamon. It gives a distinction. One is a trelis, but it's really the color of purple. So there were, in recent years, there was a person, a specific professor, Zideben, who's, I think he's still alive, he lives, he's retired, and he lives in Shoresh, which is an hour's walk from where the NCSY learning program is in the summer. I met him a couple of years ago, he invited me to come, he's retired, so they have retirement housing in this location, Shoresh, they have a big hotel. Glad Kosher, and they have seminaries, girls' schools, yeshivas, both have Shabbatonim, but I was once at a Shabbaton there also. So this Professor Zideman lives there, he's retired there. So he, for years, he was selling the purple trelis, that was Rav Herzog's trelis. And finally he gave in, after many years he gave in, and he's joined along with everybody else who assumes that Rabbi Herzog was misled by the curator of the museum in Paris, and really the correct animal, the correct duck that you're supposed to use for the trelis, the halazon, is really what they use now, the Murex trunculus. And it's blue, and it's not purple. So it's interesting that this woman, this woman with the tip, she was all excited that she thought that the Emperor's palace was really a plant, a factory to process textiles and to dye the trelis. And since the Jews were the experts in dyeing the trelis, that's why they had a lot of Jews working there in that factory. These are non-kosher, these are worms, these are non-kosher things. There's a question, the Gemara has a klal. You cannot use the hide of a non-kosher animal to write a Sefer Torah Tefillin or Mezuzah on it. So there's a question, Sefer Torah Tefillin or Mezuzah Tashmish and Kedusha. What if you want to use, let's say, a shofar from a non-kosher animal? Is that acceptable? The shofar is not Tashmish and Kedusha. Shofar is what we call Tashmish and Mitzvah. If you have an old shofar that broken, it's no longer useful, they're just thrown in the garbage. If you have an old pair of tzitzis, that's all torn and worn out, so you throw it in the garbage. You have an old Sefer Torah Tefillin, a mezuzah, or even a mezuzah case, or even the cellophane wrapping that you wrap the mezuzah in, that's called Tashmish Kedusha, that you have to put in shenis. So the Gemara only says that you cannot use hide from a non-kosher animal, the right Sefer Torah Tefillin, a mezuzah, that's Tashmish Kedusha. What about by a shofar? Can you use a shofar of a non-kosher animal? Let's say you want to do chalitza, so the chalitza shoe has to be made from leather. Can you use the leather from a non-kosher animal? So the Rabbi Natam is machmer by the chalitza shoe, we're machmer on that. Most of the shoes, all the shoes that we wear, are horse leather. So you can't use a normal shoe that has horse leather to do chalitza, because we're machmer like the Rabbi Natam. Chalitza shoe is a tashmish, a mitzvah, so it has to be from a kosher animal, even though the leather is not treif, the leather is not roi lachila. So leather, whether it's from a kosher animal, non-kosher animal, you can't say that it's treif, it's inedible, it's not roi for human consumption. But nonetheless, the Gemara learns from a pasuk, say for Torah Tefillin Mezuzah, you may not use the hide, but to use the shofar from a non-kosher animal, so the Ramah is machmer, he quotes a ran. The ran is mesupik about it, but the Ramah doesn't quote that it's a sufik. Ramah says that it's not acceptable. So we're machmer about that. The question is, Rabbi Yehuda raised the question. They were trying to, Rabbi Yehuda lived in the 1700s. And this Radzina Rebbe was in the late 1800s. Rabbi Yehuda was wondering, does the halazon, which is the source of the trelas, does it have to be a kosher fish, or can it even be a non-kosher thing? Here, according to Rabbi Herzog, halazon is a worm. A malak, a mollusk is a worm. So it's certainly not kosher. It has no fins or scales at all. So the Rabbi Yehuda raised the question. He has a tshuva about it. Then his son has also a tshuva printed in the Nadi Behuda collection. Here and there, some of the tshuvas in the Nadi Behuda were written by the son of the Nadi Behuda. As this, now the printers want to make more money, so they sell you 3 volumes of Nadi Behuda. They're really only 2 volumes, Madura Kama, Madura Tinyana. The third volume is really Shivas Tzion. These are the tshuvas by the son of the Nadi Behuda. But now, the printers want to make money, so they charge you 50% more. They sell you 3 volumes, and they call all 3 Tshuvas Nadi Behuda. So some of the tshuvas in the first 2 volumes are also by the son of the Nadi Behuda. So the son has a longer arichas than the father on this. Then someone published the Aruch with footnotes, halachic comments and footnotes. Again, there's a long, in the comments written by the Nadi Behuda's son on the Aruch, there's a long essay about this topic. Do we have to assume that the halazon must be a kosher fish or not? Even if one will be machmir to say that tzitzis, which is only tashmishei mitzvah, you have to use only from a kosher animal. But over here, just talking about the dye, you're not talking about the actual substance, the material itself. You're just talking about the dye. So maybe we should apply the principle in the Gemara that chazusa lav milsa. Gemara in the end of a kama, in a totally different context. As a discussion, when you have a garment that's dyed a certain color, you say you have 2 things, you have the garment and you have the color. How do you say, no, the color doesn't exist as a separate entity, the color was absorbed into the garment, you just have a garment. Chazusa la milsa, you don't consider the chazusa, the coloring, as if it's a separate entity. And that's what the Nadi Behuda and his son raised the question. Is it possible to assume that the halazon is a trefa fish? We assume that it is. Now that we realize that the word chalazon means a mollusk, a mollusk is a worm inside. After the Second World War, the factory in Radzin for manufacturing chalas was destroyed. And all the people who knew how to make it were all killed. And the Radzina Hasidim, who moved to Eretz Yisrael, wanted to make a factory all over again. So the only way they knew what the procedure was from Rabbi Herzog's essay, because he corresponded with the one who ran the factory before the war, before everybody was killed. But Rabbi Herzog said that the whole thing was a mistake, that the chemist in Italy fooled the Rebbe, and everything that they're using is everything the Radzina Rebbe was using for trailers is a mistake. So the Radzina Hasidim said, Pagina Dibura, we only accept half of what Rabbi Herzog said. He told us what the system was, how the Rebbe told the factory people to make the trelas, they're going to continue. And even though Rabbi Herzog said the whole thing was a mistake, that the chemist fooled the Rebbe, that they don't follow. So there used to be 3 different trelas in Yisrael. There used to be Radzina, after the war, Radzina Hasidim still make their trelas. Then you have this group makes the trelas the way Rabbi Herzog initially suggested, this malas, this murex trunculus. Then you had this Professor Ziedemann, he was making his own trelas that was purple. He finally gave in, and he's encouraging everyone to use the blue trelas. I was told that today is the Yahrzeit of the Rekeach, so someone said I should say a few words about the Rekeach. The Rekeach was from the later Balei HaTosfos. Originally we had Rashi, was a great Goen. Rashi had tons of traditions, how to read Gemara, how to read Tanakh, and how to paskin l'halacha. And then Rashi's grandchildren, the Rashbam, learned with Rashi. The Rashbam's younger brother, the Rabbi Natan, was a little child when Rashi died, so he never learned with Rashi. So the Rashbam never disagrees. I don't think he ever disagrees with Rashi. Rabbi Natan felt very free to disagree with Rashi. He never learned with his grandfather. Then after Rashi passed away, there was a third brother who was named Shlomo. He was named after Rashi. So the three brothers were the Rashbam, the oldest brother, Rabbeinu Tam, and the Rabbeinu Shlomo. So the original Balei HaTosfos were the grandchildren of Rashi, and their relatives, and their children, and their nephews, and so on, and the family got bigger and bigger, and then they had yeshivas, and then they had many talmidim. So this was going on for quite a while, they had Balei HaTosfos. So in the later generations, different styles of psak were introduced by the later Balei HaTosfos. So the Hasidi Ashkenaz were from the later Balei HaTosfos, Tzaddikim who were Machmir in Germany. The Hasidi Ashkenaz introduced a new theme into psak halacha that they tried to satisfy all the different opinions. This was in the later generation. The Maharam Rutenberg, who was the Rebbe of the Rosh, he was in the later generations, from the later Balei HaTosfos. He was thought of the end of the Balei HaTosfos. So he went along with that style to introduce all the chumras, to try to satisfy all the different opinions. And his ideas are quoted in Shulchan Aruch every so often. For example, it's a common practice on the second day of Rosh Hashanah when we say Kiddush, the second night of Rosh Hashanah. So we have either Pri Chodesh or Beged Chodesh. We're wearing a Beged Chodesh because there's a machlekes when he's supposed to say Shachyanu or not. So maybe a brachal of atal if you say shachyanu and you didn't need it, so you have a pichadus b'gachadus. So for sure, you got to say shachyanu. So that was introduced by the Maharam Rutenberg, and he has over 10 places in Shulchan Aruch where they quote such chumras in different areas. So another aspect that was introduced by the later Balei HaTosfos, namely the Rekech, is one of them is in Yonim of Kabbalah were introduced into practice. The earlier days they didn't have any of this Kabbalah. Zohar was only discovered, all the Kabbalah sources were only discovered later. Everything was hidden in the earlier years. So the Rekeach is like a kid's Shulchan Aruch. It tells you regular dinim. So a lot of what the Rekeach says is elementary. Everybody knows from the kid's Shulchan Aruch. And every so often, he writes over a din and he puts in his original version of what the din should be. And then with respect to the Nusach HaTfilah, then he has a lot of Kabbalah. He tells you how many words there are in every tefillah, how many letters there are. The Chayyadim, every so often, will quote from the Rekeach that you should leave out a Vav or add on a Hey over here, because it has to have so many letters, so you have to add a word and take out a word, because everything is based on the Rekeach. All Kabbalah, Kabbanis in the davening. Once in a while, they'll quote something from the Rekech in Halacha, in Shulchan Aruch. There's one particular din which is tossed around in our generation. The Shach in Yerideya quotes, Shach often quotes from the Rekech. When he's trying to figure out a din, the Bosom Chola, the Taruvus Malitha, every so often they'll quote from the Rekech. So there's one specific din that the Shach quotes from the Rekech, that if girl is married to a kohen and she's pregnant with a baby, and it's a 50-50 chance whether it's a boy or a girl. So if it's a boy, the question is, kohanim, male kohanim, are not permitted to attend a funeral. So is she permitted to attend a funeral? There's a 50-50 chance she may be in violation of being the tami kohen. So the Rekech says, well, it's 50-50 whether it's a zachar nekeva. Even if it turns out to be a zachar, there is a chance that there will be a hapala, a chance that there may be a miscarriage, maybe that this baby will never be born alive. So that's what he calls, the Rekeach calls this a svek sveka. 50-50 zachar nekeva, even if it's zachar, may turn out to be a nefel, so the odds are lahakel. So therefore she's permitted to attend the funeral. That's a shada today. A lot of the women know before the baby is born that it is going to be a zachar. So if you know it's a zachar already, so you just have the far-fetched possibility, the mivut possibility that it may be an eichel. So there's nothing there to be nekel based on. So that's what some rabbanim of our generation say. If the woman knows she's, if the eish is kohen knows she's carrying a baby boy, then she should not be metamei lemeis. A lot of the women have such a superstition that a pregnant woman is not permitted to attend a funeral. So one of the Gedolim writes, the says in Sefer Chaim Avroch LeMishmer Sholem, by one of the major poskim in the early 1900s, has all of Hilchas Avelos alphabetically arranged. So he writes in his Sefer that someone must have overheard the Rabbanim discussing this topic, and they misheard it. A pregnant woman is permitted to attend a funeral. The only discussion was whether Eishes Kayan, who is pregnant, is allowed to attend a funeral. Is this a valid Svek Sveka or not? So this is a famous Rekeach. And the Rekeach has every so often, he has some unique presentation of Aloch. This is the famous one that's tossed about in our generation. The Mogen Avraham, in Hilchas Shabbos, when the Shulchan Aruch talks about chinuch for children, how parents have to be mechanech children. So the din is that the parents have to be careful not to allow the child to violate an aveira. So nonetheless, Eishes Kohen Mul Beris is permitted to attend a funeral because of the Svek Sveka, so it's not a problem. So the Mogen Avraham quotes this Shach in Yerideya, who quotes this from the Rekeach. So the Magen Avraham is bothered with the Kasha. There is a Mishnah in Chulin, Berak Behemam Kasha, the fourth Berak in Chulin, that states that Tahara Blua is not Mekabel Tumah. Let's say somebody swallows a ring and the ring is in the stomach. Or a woman is pregnant and the baby, the fetus, is in her rechem, in her womb. And the person goes to a funeral. The same oil on me. So the person attends the funeral becomes tummy. But the ring in the stomach or the fetus inside the womb is what we call Tahara Balua. It's Balua inside the body. It's not the Kabbal Tumah. So what was the whole discussion in the first place? What was the whole issue that the Rekeach raised? They had to say that you have a Svek Svek at 50-50, Zohar Nekeva. Maybe it's going to be a Nepal. What's the whole problem? Tahara Balua is not the Kabbal Tumah. So in before the war, before the Second World War, there were two brothers-in-law married to two sisters. One was Rabbi Chaim Weiser, prominent Boisek in Vilna. One was Rabbi Chana Basman. They were married to the two daughters of the rabbi from Shabel. Shabel is a big city. I remember when we were driving to Shabel, it took around 45 minutes to go from one end of the city to the other. They both came up with the same idea, I think independently of each other, that apparently the Rekeach is of the opinion that a Kohen is not allowed to come in contact with a mace, even if he has a stunt, even if he has a trick, whereby he won't become Tamei, like over here. The baby, the fetus is inside the mother's rechem, so the fetus does not become Tamei, but still, the baby, the fetus is still in the oil on mace. So that's a chiddush. The Rekeach apparently thinks that it's prohibited for the Kohen to come in contact with a mace, even if coming in contact will not cause him to become tamei. That's why the Rekeach had come up with a different explanation why it's permissible, because of what he calls the Svek Svek. When we daven in the shul, Mincha, Myra, Shachris, when we daven in the shul, so they have there a list of all of the people from their community who were killed by the Nazis. So there are 14 names in a row, but the family name is Papo. Papo was a very prominent Sfarish family that had many Rabbanim. When Rab David Pardo came from Venice to function as a Malamed, it split. So the people, the Balabatim, didn't know how to size him up, how learned he was. But the rabbi at that time was also from the Papo family. He recognized this young man, this Rabbi David Pardo, was really very strong in learning. So the rabbi encouraged the Balabatim they should be mechabed him. And after the rabbi passed away, then they made Rabbi David Pardo. After Rabbi Papo passed away, then they made Rabbi David Pardo, that was in the middle of 1700, they made him the dayan in the city. And then when he was offered, he became more famous. Then he was offered the Rabbanis in what was the name of the other city that we visited? I forgot. Sarajevo. So then that was a better position. So then he moved to Sarajevo. In later years, David had a possibility. There was a Havamina that he was going to get as one of the tour guides, some professor, Eliezer Papo, who was at Ben Gurion University. The name Eliezer Papo is a very famous name. That was the name of the author of the Pelu Yoetz. Rabbi Eliezer Papa was born in the late 1700s and died in the early 1800s. He was born in Sarajevo. He was a big tzaddik, and he wrote this sefer. He wrote a few svarim. He wrote svarim in halacha, but the one that's most popular now is the Pelu Yoetz. Pelu Yoetz is alphabetically arranged short essays on different topics. Like one of my grandchildren got as a gift from the Rebbe in the yeshiva, because he was learning well, a young child, I think he's 9 years old or something, he got a sefer Pelu Yoetz and has the kudus. So whenever I visit by that daughter, so my grandson always says, I should read him a chapter in the Pelu Yoetz. We have a neighbor in Washington Heights, Molly Resnick, who was born in Bulgaria. She speaks, I think, 7 different languages. She travels around the world to speak for Lubavitch, the Mechazik women in Lubavitch, the Tznias and Shmiris HaMitzvahs, and so on. So she has a copy because she lived in Bulgaria when she was very young. Later she moved to Eretz Yisrael. She lived in Bulgaria. She says nobody was religious at that time. And then she became a Balas Tshuva later in life. So because she came from Bulgaria, so that's their sefer, is the Pelu Yoetz. She learns the Pelu Yoetz from time to time. Pelu Yoetz would have, let's say, on the Aleph, he would talk about achilo. So is it right to eat ice cream? Is it right to eat a lot of cakes with a lot of icing and so on? Based on the base, he would write begodim, what kind of clothing should you wear? He himself, personally, was a big ascetic. He was always fasting taneisim, always davening, always learning. He never enjoyed olam hazeh. He died at a very young age. He died at the age of he was born in Sarajevo, but then he got a rabbanus in Silvestra, something like that, somewhere in Bulgaria. And he died at the age of 41. And after he passed away, then someone told over the story, which is now printed in when they have the biographies of the family as a papo, the Pelu Yoetz. So they write this part of the story. He had a cholam. He had a dream that ben Hashemayim, there was going to be a magefa, and a lot of people from the community were going to die. And the rabbi, Rabbi Eliezer Papo, had the option, if he'll give up his life, he will save the whole community. Strange, he was given the choice. Should he die, and Nisan Sadikim will be mechaper on the whole community, or he didn't deserve to die, so maybe there would be a magefa on the community. So he volunteered. He wants to die to save the community. So he died at the age of 41, very young age. And he wrote several svarim. The most famous is the Pelu Yoetz. Many quotes from the Pelu Yoetz. There's a lot of Musar. He quotes Mamari Chazal, like the Mesillas Yesharim. He puts together Mamari Chazal, and Psukim from Tanakh, and Agadatis, and Halachas. Beautiful essays on topics, and it's all arranged alphabetically. On the Alephase. And every so often he'll quote in the Pelu Yoetz different Minas Chasidus from his father. His father was a big Talmud Chacham, he was a big tzaddik. So that's the Papo family. It was a very famous family. It was a rabbinical family for many years. Before we went on the trip, I looked at a book in the Gottesman Library at the city Mostar. Is that the name of the city? Mostar.
Mostar.
So they have about recent history in the city. They have different chapters. And they have one chapter about halachic issues that came up in the city. So they sent their shilas always to other rabbanim from other communities. So they have a big section, something like 60 pages long, about all the halachic shilas that came up. The overwhelming majority of the shilas were about agunas. Apparently the people from Mostar some of the men made a good living, and they would be killed, they would be murdered by gangsters while traveling on the highway when they were carrying a lot of money. And they wouldn't have conclusive proof that this was, that they couldn't conclusively identify the dead body as being the dead body of this woman to be Mata the Aguna. So that's the bulk of the shilas were about Agunas. I was wondering, was that something unusual? I'm not sure, because when you study Shulchan Aruch, the very longest siman in all of Arba Echad L'Shulchan Aruch, I think, is Eben Ezra siman Yud Zayin, which is the siman about Heter Agunas. That's the history of the Jewish people in Golus, that they were always pogromers. There were always husbands who were missing, and the wives were Agunas. And you never know for sure that the husband was dead. So how much inconclusive evidence can you accept? How much circumstantial evidence can you accept? How do you have to identify the dead body to know that the woman is Mutaris Leinosis? I'm not sure whether it's something unique to Muster, or that's probably in all of Chubas. Probably the majority, although over here, the Chubas over here from this area, most of the Chubas are Dini Mamanis. But Reb Yitzchak Hanan's Chubas, there's a whole volume on Agunas. Most of the Shalas that Reb Yitzchak Hanan took care of, because people corresponded from out of town. Most of the Shalas he took care of were Taka Agunas Shalas. And in the Shulchan Aruch, the longest Simon is Simon Yutain, Heter Agunas. It's probably nothing unusual that the Shalas that they sent to the other communities, to the big Rabbanim, the Paskim, were all on Hilchas Agunas. It was mentioned previously that today is the yahrzeit of the author of the Rakeach. So we mentioned one issue before that's tossed about today, for many years already, about Rakeach's Chiddush, that a girl who's married to a Kohen and is pregnant with a baby is permitted to attend the funeral, and the whole discussion that followed. There's another issue. The Rakeach counted every word and every letter in the Tfilas. Much was based on Kabbalah. So according to the opinion of the Rekeach, when we recite Kaddish, we mention 10 praises of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and these somehow correspond to the Aseres HaDibros. So in the beginning we say Yizkadal V'Yizkadash, those are two. Then we say Yizbarach V'Yishtabach V'Yizporar V'Yizshamam V'Yiznasei V'Yizador V'Yizalev V'Yizalol, those are 8. So the first two and the last 8 add up to 10. That's supposed to correspond to the Aseres HaDibros. Why do we separate them? Why do we have Yizkadal V'Yizkadash in the beginning and the other 8 later? So the Rekeach explains that the Aseres HaDibros were in 2 different units, the first 2 and the last 8. The Gemara points out, based on the grammatical construct of the Psukim, that the first 2, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is speaking to Bnei Yisrael in person. Anochi Hashem Elokecho, Asher Hotzei Sicho Me'eretz Mitzrayim, Lo Yiyu Lecha Elohim Acherim Al Panai, Ribono Shel Olam is speaking. And from the third on, it's Moshe Rabbeinu speaking, Lo Siso Shem Hashem Elokecho Lashav, Ki Lo Yinake Hashem. And instead of saying Lo Siso Shmi Lashav, Ki Lo Anake, in first person, it's in third person. Moshe Rabbeinu is speaking. HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe Rabbeinu the last 8. Moshe Rabbeinu tells it over to Bnei Yisrael. So because the first 2, Anochi V'Liyeh Lecha, were directly told to us by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so for some Kabbalistic reason, the Rekech thinks those 2 should be recited in Hebrew. Instead of saying Yizgadal V'Yizkadash, the Rekech thinks they should say Yizgadel V'Yizkadesh. And because the other 8 were told to us by Moshe Rabbeinu, so they're separated from the first 2. And the other 8 should be in Aramaic, like the rest of the Kaddish is Aramaic. Others have a tradition, the Balatanya follows the Arizal's Nusach, that you only say 7 praises of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The first 2 don't count. And the second time after Yeshmei Rabbo, you say 7 praises instead of 8, and you leave out the last one, Yishalol. In Europe, it was very rare that anybody said Yizgadel Yizkadesh. People who remember from Europe, those who learned in the Lithuanian yeshivas, say that was not the practice anywhere in Lithuania. Even in the Goyen's clothes, even in the shul in Vilna, where the Vilna Goyen centuries ago used to daven, used to learn, there also they didn't daven the Nusach HaKroh. Maybe there was a short period of time after he died that they did, but in recent years he didn't. But The reason why it became more popular today that people say Yis Kadesh, Yis Kadesh, because everybody looks in the Mishnah Berurah. After the Second World War, so the Torah was had a resurgence because all the Talmidei Chachamim in Eretz Yisrael and in Europe and America, they were all teaching Torah. There was a big resurgence in Limud HaTorah. And everybody at one time or another had either learned in Raten or visited the Chafetz Chaim for a bracha to be part of the army, or a bracha for Hatzlacha. So everybody felt in a certain way or another kafuf to the Chafetz Chaim. That's why in recent years the Mishnah Berurah became so popular. So the Mishnah Berurah quotes this from the Rekeach. That was the practice of the Gra, the Vilna Gaon. The Chafetz Chaim personally used to daven Nusach HaGra. The davening followed the Nusach HaGra. But he didn't, as far as the rest of the davening, he didn't recommend that everybody else should daven Nusach HaGra. But here in the Mishnah Berurah and Hilchas Kaddish, he quotes this from the Rekech, that the first two should be said in Hebrew, Yisgadel Yisgadesh. That whole story comes from the Rekech. And we were touring in the National, what was it?
Park.
National Park. So Roni mentioned that a lot of these things that they have, they think are millions of centuries old. This poses a problem. The scientists determine the age of the earth or the age of different things based on the rate of decomposition of carbon. They know how long it takes. They know what the rate of decomposition is now. And they assume that nature didn't change and it was always the same. So based on that scientific rate of decomposition, they come up with this age of the earth. So this poses a problem. In our Torah it says the world is approximately 6,000 years old. It's not these billions of years old. So as we were walking, different suggestions were made. Different Talmidei Chachamim in recent years, when this issue was brought up, so different Talmidei Chachamim gave different suggestions. So some suggested that the Mabul, during the time of the Mabul, the scientific rules were cockeyed. The whole earth was covered with burning hot water, except for Eretz Yisrael. That's the tradition that the Gemara has. There are no walls separating Eretz Yisrael from the rest of the world, but the Gemara's tradition is that the Mabul did not affect Eretz Yisrael. But the rest of the world was affected. And Yomim V'Layla, all the seasons of the year, Kites and Choref, everything was cockeyed, nothing was functioning normally. That's what some suggest. Maybe during the course of that year of the Mabul, maybe everything aged a lot. So it gives the mistaken impression as if it's millions of years old. Others suggest that maybe the 6 days, the Sheshes Mei Bereishis, were millions of years. Maybe they're not really days the way we know a day of 24 hours. For purpose of the Molad Halvana and for the Tkufis, so the calculations is based on the assumption that the Sheshes Mei Bereishis were 24 hours each. But it could be that that's not a kasha. It could be that in truth they were really millions of years old. And that's where all of these years came from. Others suggest, based on Midrashim and based on sources in Kabbalah, that this was not the first world that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created. The Medrash has, based on Mashmoyos of Psukim, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created a world first, and then he destroyed it, he decided he doesn't like it, and he created another world, he destroyed that, he was Bere Olamos Umachrivo. So some suggest that he didn't destroy the worlds and cause them to fall back into non-existence. Everything was on this globe. He created a world and then he destroyed it. Then he created a second time on top of the first. And all of the things that are millions of years old are from the original Mahaduras. The original time that he created the world. We don't really understand these Midrashim. What does that mean? That the Ribbono Shel Olam created the world and he decided he doesn't like it, so he destroyed it, then he created another world. inside it doesn't like that, till he finally created our world. What do you mean by human beings you have like that? A person has chaloimus. A boy thinks he's going to marry such a girl who looks like this. And you're going to have so many children. You're going to do this and this for a living. You're going to live in Croatia. Mm-hmm. On the edge of the sea, whatever. People have chaloimus. And then it doesn't always happen like that. He doesn't always marry that kind of girl. He doesn't always make such a parnasa. He doesn't always live on the beach and so on. And it doesn't happen like that. But by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he created the world just by basar mamaras nivra ha'olam. Whatever he said came into existence. So if the Rebbe Shalom would have wanted to create a beautiful world, he didn't even have to snap his fingers. He just has to make a maimer piv, make a wish, a desire. I want a beautiful world to come into existence, and the world would be beautiful. How can it be that he created a world and he decided later on he's not happy with it? So what did he want in the first place? Why didn't he say, I want to have a world that'll make me happy, that I won't be happy with? How can it be that he misjudged? It doesn't make sense. That's only possible by human beings. So I remember Rabbi Soloveitchik once suggested an interpretation in this Medrash, similar to a Rashi who quotes a Medrash on Parshas Bereishis. When Hashem created the world in 6 days, so it says on the seventh day, Shavas, Ayinafash, Hashem relaxed, and he took it easy. He didn't work so hard anymore. So the Medrash is bothered with Akasha, that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world, he didn't have to exert any effort or energy, that he had to work so hard, that he had to relax and rest up on the seventh day. HaKadosh Baruch Hu just had, he didn't even have to say, Mayim Rapiv. It says Asara Esapamim 10 times of Yom Elakim. So the Asara Mamoras doesn't really mean that Rabbi Shalom said. He just had a desire that these things should come to existence. It came to existence. So what kind of an expression is it? That Shabbos Vayinu Hafash. So Rashi quotes from the Medrash that the Chachamim comment, Ichtiv b'yatzmu menucha. Kodesh Baruch Hu dictated to Moshe Rabbeinu right in the Chumash that I rested on Shabbos. It's not really true, but it's not a lie either. So why did Kodesh Baruch Hu ichtiv b'yatzmu? Why did he dictate to Moshe Rabbeinu that he relaxed on Shabbos? To teach human beings that they shouldn't become workaholics, that they should rest up a little bit. That man was created b'tzelem Elokim. Kodesh Baruch Hu instructed Bnei Yisrael, v'halachta b'drachav, we have an obligation to preserve our Tzelem Elokim. The Ummah Olam were also created by Tzelem Elokim. They can preserve their Tzelem Elokim as well. They weren't, it's not from the Shevet Mitzvahs Bnei Nayach, but if they'd be interested in it, they can also do it. And the pasuk following this, v'halachta b'drachav, in Parshas Kisavo, the very next pasuk reads, v'ra'u kalami ha'oretz, when all the nations of the world will see, Yishem Hashem Nikru Alecho, that you have succeeded in preserving your Tzelem Elokim, Yishem Hashem Nikru Alecho, and they were also created by Tzelem Elokim. So they will learn from us that they can do the same. They can preserve that Tzelem Elokim. The Yoru Mimeko, they will learn from us how they can lead a life of Yerushalayim. If we lead a life of Yerushalayim, We have the ability to preserve our Tzelem Elokim. So Bnei Yisrael is supposed to serve as an Or LaGoyim, that all the Yeshaya says, and the Chumash it says it as well. Ro Kalam Hirotz, Bnei Yisrael will serve as an Or LaGoyim, not with respect to Shabbos, Kashrus, and Taras HaMishpacha, that's only for us, but in these type of things, honesty, integrity, accomplishments, gold, values, and so on. So in Tzelem Elokim, the Ummah Olam will see that we have succeeded in preserving our Tzelem Elokim, so they will learn from us how they too can act with Yoram Mimeka, to act with Yerushalayim, and to preserve their Tzelem Elokim as well. So just like Rashi quotes from the Medrash, Shabbos Vayin Afash was only Hichtiv B'Yatzmo. It's not really true. Kodesh Baruch Hu told Moshe Rabbeinu, write that expression in the Chumash, so the human beings will know that they shouldn't become workaholics. They should rest up a little bit. Because they have to preserve their Tzelem Elokim. They have to act the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu acts. So this is the way the Torah describes HaKadosh Baruch Hu acting. So Rav Soloveitchik suggested maybe the Midrashim read this in the Psukim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Bari Olamus and Machrivon, to teach human beings a lesson. That even if a person at the age of 85 realizes that he wasted his whole life, he never did any Torah mitzvahs, and he comes to the realization that he's bankrupt, totally bankrupt, his life was totally useless. There's always a chance to fix it up at the end. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created a world and he didn't like it, he destroyed it, created another world, started all over again, a third time, a fourth time, till he finally created this world. And he said, Dein Hanyali, this world I like. So the Torah implies that HaKadosh Baruch Hu acted like that. So we should do V'halachta B'drocha, we can do the same thing. We can do tshuva. No need to wait till the age of 85. But we shouldn't think that it's... So we should never be nisyayish. We should never give up hope that we can ever straighten out the mess that we created. We can always straighten out, just like HaKadosh Baruch Hu with Borei Lomas and Machrivan. So too the human beings can do the same thing.